Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker, and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at several big stories. First, we talk with Dr. Hannah Dickinson in our regular segment, Women and Society. Today, we discuss Elizabeth Warren's proposed child care plan, President Trump's attempts to destroy Title X funding for family planning, and government inaction in the face of skyrocketing rates of HIV contraction among Black women in the United States. And then, today we continue our weekly series, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker secured the endorsement of Amy Nielsen, a state representative in Iowa. The endorsement of Iowa lawmakers is highly sought after by presidential contenders because of the state's early caucus vote. Nielsen was the first Iowa state legislator to endorse a presidential candidate. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif resigned yesterday, saying, quote, "I apologize for my inability to continue serving and for all the shortcomings during my term in office. I hope my resignation will act as a spur for the foreign ministry to regain its proper statutory role in the conduct of foreign affairs," unquote. President Hassan Rouhani has not said whether he has or will accept Zarif's resignation. Zarif has favored detente with the West, while his critics have labeled the nuclear deal he negotiated as a capitulation to the country's enemies. French President Emmanuel Macron denounced yellow vest protesters today, saying, quote, "Those who join violent demonstrations are complicit with the worst. It's a miracle that after so many Saturdays marred by violence, there have been no deaths resulting from police action," unquote. But actually, 11 people have died since the protests began in November, including an 80-year-old woman who was hit with a police-fired tear gas canister. This past weekend, protests continued with another 47,000 demonstrators taking part. A U.S. appeals court today authorized wireless carrier AT&T's bid to buy massive media corporation Time Warner in an $85.4 billion merger. The argument that the Department of Justice made against the merger is that AT&T, a provider of service for Time Warner's television shows, could raise prices for other content providers, which would result in higher prices for consumers. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our regular Tuesday segment, Women and Society, with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. In this weekly segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. Hannah Dickinson is a professor and an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. Professor Dickinson joins us from Geneva, New York. And we're joined here in studio by Nicole Roussel, a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. Welcome back.
Thanks.
So happy to be here.
So Hannah, where should we start today?
I think we should talk about the Trump administration's newest attacks on women's health, this time attacks on Title X funding. How's that sound?
Yeah. So what's going on?
So maybe it's useful just to start with what Title X is. So Title X was created as part of the Public Health Service Act and is signed into law by President Nixon in 1970, who we will recall is a Republican and conservative, right? So this is actually not the kind of far left bill that the Republicans would have us think it is. It's a program that was designed and continues to be designed to support family planning and women's reproductive health. And so it's a grant-funded program, and those grants are run out of the federal government. So for the last 50 years or so, that program through grants has covered critical health care for poor women, for uninsured women, like birth control, cancer screenings, STI testing and treatment. And I will just say currently 2/3 of people who receive care through the Title X program live in poverty. So that's what we're talking about. What the Trump administration has gone ahead and done is ban Title X providers from referring patients for abortion services. And also, among the other things that this new guidance from the Trump administration would do is force abortion providers who get Title X funding to physically and financially separate abortion services from other planning, family planning services.
Hannah, a lot of our listeners probably aren't old enough to remember Ronald Reagan's attack on women's rights and on women's choice. But I'm old enough to remember it. Ronald Reagan talked a lot about being pro-life, but in the end didn't really do a lot to force the issue through the courts, not like what we're seeing now under Donald Trump. Is this a new strategy that those on the pro-choice side are going to have to learn to counter? Or is this an anomaly? Is Donald Trump just trying to prove his conservative bona fides for those Republicans or those voters who believe that he's not really a conservative?
Well, I think it's both, John. It is both not new and clearly an attempt from the Trump administration to pander to their base. So Reagan actually tried a similar move around Title X funding, because he didn't make it to the end of his term before that was approved, it never really happened. So in some ways, like, this is out of the old Republican playbook. I think the things maybe in terms of motivation for the Trump administration to really point to here are, first, you'll recall that Donald Trump ran on a platform that included defunding Planned Parenthood. And so it is very clear that part of what this new Title IX guidance or Title X guidance does is essentially defund Planned Parenthood. So the 41% of Title X patients receive their preventative health care through Planned Parenthood. And Planned Parenthood has said that if this new guidance is finalized, they will no longer accept any Title X funding. And for them, it's because they've said they will not tell doctors not to give their patients all of the necessary health information. It doesn't, you know, it's not hard to imagine here a scenario in which we might see a mother whose health is at risk because of a pregnancy, and doctors are saying, we will not avoid talking about abortion with those mothers. And of course, that's an extreme example. It should be the case that any pregnant woman is availed of all of her options and has an actual choice to make about what she does with her health. But instead, we are seeing a sort of further division in access to healthcare here, where wealthy women and well-off women, women who have private insurance, they still have access not only to abortion, but all of the reproductive health care they might need, while poor and uninsured women won't have that access. And in most places in the country, don't have access to abortion. And I should just say, just so we're very clear, because of the Hyde Amendment, none of these clinics, the Planned Parenthood clinics and others, are using any federal funds to fund abortion, right? That's not happening. It's not currently allowed, although, you know, again, that is absurd. So this is like some argument around how, well, maybe through the back door, say through using funds to promote a program, maybe there's some close proximity to abortion here. Right, that again just shows that I don't actually think abortion is the target here. I think Planned Parenthood is. And I will just add, I think the other motivation for Trump and the Republicans is that this new Title X guidance would allow religious-based and anti-abortion groups to qualify for federal money that they historically have not, because this new guidance removes the requirement that Title X providers offer information or referrals for abortion, right? So that was one reason that anti-abortion groups weren't accessing this money. And so I think we can expect, if this all moves forward, to see crisis pregnancy centers and other anti-abortion supposed healthcare providers using Title X funding for those types of programs instead of what we should be seeing, access to women's health.
Hannah, you know, these programs, these Title X funds are, again, like you said, earmarked for places that provide birth control, cancer screenings, STI testing, really, you know, basic healthcare needs for women and for men, for people of any gender. These are just basic needs. Everyone can get cancer. Everyone can get STIs. These are needs that everyone has and needs that every family has. If there are people who need mammograms or who need birth control, you know, these are things that human beings need. And abortions are in that list, right? These are abortions are family planning. They are for women's health, for people who are pregnant or might be pregnant, for their health. When did abortion become such a politicized issue? And you say that you don't think this is actually targeting abortion, but it's targeting Planned Parenthood. Is this just a class-based attack, or what do you see this as?
If I knew the answer to that question, Nicole. I think that I don't think it can be one thing, right? I mean, I think the moment that Roe v. Wade passed, we saw the far right really mobilize in opposition to any access to abortion. So, right. So that's been there sort of from the inception of access to abortion, legal access to abortion for women in the U.S. But I think we can't ignore the fact that this is a galvanizing issue for many people on the right, and also for folks that have, you know, religious or other opposition to abortion. So I think one way this works is to help bring together actually a coalition of people that otherwise may have less in common. But I also think it is without a doubt part of a war on the poor and part of a war on women. It's sort of impossible to read through that the Title X material out of the Trump administration and not think on some level this is simply about enacting dominance, right? Saying we, largely men in government, we have a right to say what women and in particular what poor women can do with their bodies. So I think it's pretty hard to disentangle the misogyny and the patriarchy and the white supremacy from these other political motivations where, you know, far-right consultants know that this gets out voters, that this gets out donors, you know, in some ways like the NRA does, for example.
In a related topic, another news story that you wanted to talk about was the U.S. failing Black women with HIV. I see it is very related, right? This continues to be a lens of misogynoir, of white supremacy, of misogyny toward Black women in particular, especially when HIV rates are, improving in other sectors of the U.S. population. Can you tell us what's going on here?
Yeah, so I really did want to talk about this story in relation to this new news about Title X, a new report out revealing that 60% of newly diagnosed cases of HIV in women are from Black women. Which, of course, doesn't match the population of Black women in the U.S. at all. And so to me, this just seemed like a really clear example of how the new approach to Title X out of reactionary approach to Title X out of the Trump administration will cause the death of women. Right. I mean, that's just and men. Right. Who seek STI treatment from Planned Parenthood and other providers. So we're not just talking about an abstract war on women in which we have to put up with regular misogynistic comments from our president. We're actually talking about Title X program and funding that will result in more women. And if we look at these statistics, particularly Black women dying because they don't have access to reproductive health care.
Yeah, one of the statistics in this piece that's on truthout.org that's written by an HIV researcher, you know, you already mentioned that it's 60% of new diagnoses is of Black women with HIV, but of the people who have the people who have HIV, Black Americans are nearly 10 times more likely to be diagnosed with AIDS, right? So this also indicates a further lack of access to healthcare because we know that the people who are getting diagnosed are more likely to be Black. But the HIV researcher also notes that the people who already have HIV are more likely to get AIDS and have that virus get even further and further along. And then she also mentions that the likelihood that people are diagnosed in the first place that are, you know, the likelihood that people are living with HIV without that diagnosis is also higher among the Black community. This indicates that it's just clearly a failure in healthcare to me.
Exactly. And we already know that we have a racist healthcare system, right? We know that doctors are less likely to treat and take seriously Black people, and particularly Black women's pain, that they're more likely to be skeptical of Black patients, right? That the racism works at that level. And we also know that the racism works at the level of access to healthcare. There are 103 counties where Planned Parenthood is the only provider of affordable reproductive health care. And so if Planned Parenthood stops taking Title X funds, I think we have some big questions to ask about who is it that will be providing poor women and uninsured women with health care. And if we think back about the these HIV statistics, right? Important questions. Who is it then that is diagnosing HIV in women? Who is it that is treating, who will be treating that so that it doesn't turn into AIDS? And we know that the health providers that work in communities have done some of the work, right? To start to think about the racism that cuts through our healthcare system, the sexism that cuts through our healthcare system. And not only are we lopping off access with the new Title X guidance, but we're also taking providers away who have dedicated some real time to learning about how best to meet the needs and reach poor and uninsured women.
Relatedly, you know, here, right here in DC, in the nation's capital, this report cites that Black Americans are 75% of all HIV cases here in the District of Columbia. And that's, you know, right where Donald Trump is currently living at the White House. And Donald Trump, in his recent, very recent State of the Union, declared a goal of ending HIV by 2030. So he's both attempting to cut Title X, which is, as we've talked about all day here, where a lot of Planned Parenthood, they, you know, Planned Parenthood sees 41% of Title X patients, but also where a lot of this treatment gets done. But he is also trying to end HIV by 2030. Can you explain how those two things are happening in tandem and if that goal is even remotely realistic?
No, I mean, that goal is not achievable.
Well, not with these methods that we're using.
Precisely. Without naming what this is, right? We're talking about a public health crisis. Black Americans represent a staggering 75% of all HIV cases in DC. That's health crisis. And I just don't understand a response to health crisis like that, that says, I know what we'll do. We'll cut funding and we'll tie the hands of doctors and public health providers.
And yet, to make matters worse, too, if I could interrupt you one second, is that this is not really being carried in the mainstream media. This is not something that's part of the political debate. We have a dozen people running for president right now on the Democratic side, and nobody is talking about women's health.
Well, let's move on to another really important and related piece of news that's been going on. Presidential candidate Senator Elizabeth Warren has rolled out a new affordable child care plan. Can you tell us what's going on with this? What is in this plan? And, you know, I think it's also important to talk about, you know, within the context of this, what the bigger picture is. What do women actually need for a comprehensive and meaningful child care plan that's, you know, affordable or even free, right? That's actually accessible.
Elizabeth Warren is the first of the Democratic presidential candidates to make child care plan part of her platform. So it felt important to talk about this because, for a couple of reasons, in part because it's kind of getting positioned as, see, she's the real feminist here. And so I thought it was important to, right, acknowledge that, yes, we do finally have a presidential candidate talking about affordable childcare, and also to point to some of the limits. So Elizabeth Warren's plan, you know, as it stands now, has the federal government partnering with local providers to create what she calls a network of childcare options that would be available to every family. Her plan would make those childcare options free to any family that makes less than 200% of the federal poverty line. So I don't know, just to sort of put that in some kind of perspective, for a family of two, we're talking about $17,000 a year at the poverty line. So we're talking, you know, for a family of two, if you make $34,000 a year or less, this childcare would be free for you. And then after that, she has childcare costs capped at no more than 7% of a family's income. And then another important component of this plan is increasing the pay of childcare and preschool workers. So that's what she's proposed. And so one of the things I wanted to talk a little bit about is the sort of idea of a network of childcare options. To me, that reminds me a lot of the Affordable Care Act. We sort of are back in the realm of means testing here, as well as using current private infrastructure subsidized by the government rather than, say, for example, expanding and deepening our public school system to say, instead of offering K-12 education, we now offer infant to 12 education or infant through college education in the U.S. That's an option, and yet not an option anyone is talking about.
Yeah, I mean, there's been this rising tide of progressive sentiment in the United States. I mean, you can sort of pinpoint the beginning of it in several different points causases, right? Different movements that have erupted. But, you know, it's clear that there's effectively a consensus or, you know, something approaching a consensus in society around things like single-payer health. I mean, single-payer healthcare is hugely popular. So is free college education. I think this is sort of an extension of that basic logic that people's basic needs should be guaranteed in a society, well, in any society, and especially society as wealthy as the United States. But the political class, if you want to call it that, or, you know, the politicians and, you know, the people who are really standing behind them, the big donors and the economic elites, they're making concessions. They're, you know, a lot of them feel forced to make concessions to modify their own political positions that they've held for a very long time. And you know, it's interesting, all of the limitations to this that you laid out, because, you know, it makes it clear that this is, in fact, you know, a concession, right? I mean, it's not sort of an expression of deeply held beliefs. It's sort of a modification of their positions to meet the changing times. Where do you think this is going to head now? I mean, will the movement, all these different struggles that have emerged, I think, especially since the 2008 economic crisis for social justice, do you think that they could actually push this to fruition? Does this have a chance of really becoming law?
Honestly, Walter, I don't feel super optimistic that this becomes law, at least, you know, under our current system, that we see the attack on public education currently. And so I will admit, I mean, so we may see a measure here or there, childcare subsidies, or I think we may see states trying to take this up and address childcare in coming years. But I think without a really massive societal shift, we're not actually at a point where we're talking about universal access, right? Elizabeth Warren has been calling this a universal childcare plan, but it's not, right? It kind of builds a two-tiered system right from the ground up where, like we see with our healthcare system, right? Where if you can't afford private healthcare, you receive less adequate healthcare, right? And I fear we see the same thing here. If you can't afford boutique private childcare, you're in a different system. And that's not universal. It doesn't actually hold up childcare as a universal right. So I think we need, right, to get to a point where we are talking about access to childcare as a universal right in the same way that we are struggling to talk about healthcare as a universal right, in the same way that historically we used to understand access to public education as a historical right or universal right.
Hannah, just one more point on women's healthcare or healthcare in general even. My ex-father-in-law is a physician, an important physician, but he's decided to dedicate his career to the poor and to undocumented immigrants, which is really laudable, I think. But he mentioned that a lot of his colleagues in that community are doing something now called private care. And that is, if you want to be a patient, you have to send your doctor a check for $1,500. And that gives you the right to call and make an appointment whenever you need an appointment. You can't just call and say, oh, I need an appointment. And the receptionist will say, okay, come at 2:00. Sorry, you're not feeling well. You have to pay now, cash on the barrelhead, to prove that you're serious about making sure your doctor gets paid. It's become something that is spreading across the country, he said. And he envisions a period in the near future where we get to the point where every doctor or most every doctor is going to be like this, that it's not just privatized, but it's super privatized. And only the wealthy or the upper middle class are going to be able to have medical care on demand. That's how bad things are getting.
And that's the fight we're in, right? I mean, in some ways, to come back to Walter's question about where we see things going, if we continue to build a two-tiered system in terms of who has access to healthcare, who has access to childcare, who has access to college education, essentially, like, right, who has the right to exist, right, to survive, then I think we will see a new kind of pushback. But I think it's important that we insist that any kind of privatization, when we're building a brand new universal child care program, when we're thinking about reproductive health, right, we need to be paying attention to not just the sort of crumbs that maybe we're willing through charity to give the poor in the U.S. We need to be talking about what is it that everyone has a right to, and how do we make sure that the people who are most vulnerable have the easiest access to that right? And that's not the direction we're currently going in.
And I completely agree. And, you know, the one other thing I want to add here is that when you think about what universal childcare could look like, you can think about all of the people unemployed or underemployed in this country who, you know, could be working in a public childcare system. We know childcare right now is incredibly expensive, way too expensive for many people to be able to handle. And especially as we're seeing affordable housing be completely demolished in big cities where there are lots of families. And families are getting broken apart where, you know, the older members of the family, the matriarchs, the patriarchs might not be able to stay and in those housing units and provide that childcare. It seems even more important that we provide some sort of universal childcare option. And there are plenty of people who, if we were to decide to prioritize that we would be able to pay in some sort of public option.
And which I think is really important to add to, right, that this a move toward universal childcare must also be a move toward equitable salaries for childcare and preschool workers. Those workers are, the vast majority of them are women. And so universal childcare program that works needs to recognize also that part of the reason that we childcare is expensive, but also part of the reason we see childcare deserts in so many parts of this country is because childcare workers are not paid a living wage. It is actually more expensive for them to put their own children in childcare so they can go to work than just to stay home with their own child, right? I mean, that is a system that is clearly not working.
We're going to have to leave it right there. We were joined from Geneva, New York, by Dr. Hannah Dickinson. She is a professor and an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. And we were joined here in studio by Nicole Roussel, a Sputnik News analyst and producer of this show. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today, we continue our weekly series, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start off by talking about the quote-unquote pandemic bonds that the World Bank issued. Can you explain what those are?
Yeah, I really am glad we have an opportunity to discuss this because it kind of shows the sort of crazy neo-colonial kind of rule that still exists in a larger part of the world. So the World Bank, which is this massive institution, mostly run by the United States, but also Western power interest, whose supposed job is to foster economic growth across the world as a goal of raising people out of poverty. And really what it means is promoting neoliberal capitalism, minimal state intervention, regulations, et cetera, with the goal of prying open markets to be as, you know, free, unregulated markets as possible. The World Bank 2 years ago issued what are called pandemic bonds. And what those are is, as you know, there are different countries, for example, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, who suffer from severe pandemics, such as an Ebola outbreak, which was one of the most severe that hit the Republic of the Congo recently, I think about a year ago. It claimed 500 lives and affected I don't know how many other people. These countries, because of their kind of neocolonial past, lack certain infrastructure and wealth and control over their own resources. And thus, when diseases hit, they hit hard and a lot of people die and get hurt. What the World Bank proposed as a solution is to sell bonds or have those countries sell bonds to get financing, which would then be used to create infrastructure to prevent outbreaks. Because what happens is typically when an outbreak already occurs, that's when a lot of donation money comes in, right? So, you know, Peter Gabriel, whoever, has some kind of benefit concert and everybody's really worried about the people in whatever country and then they donate money. But the idea was they wanted to have financing ahead of time before the pandemic hit so that when it does start hitting, they're ready to go. I think what it shows is kind of sort of the brutality of this capitalist mechanism that essentially is trying to allow investors to profit off of instances of disease in other countries, especially severe diseases that could reach the level of pandemic. What this Financial Times article points out, though, is that they're actually turning out to not be very profitable, that they're not paying out the way they anticipated, and that a lot of investors are getting kind of skittish around them because it turns out that trying to profit off these diseases, at least in this mechanism, is not as profitable as they wanted it to be, and they're not paying out the way they're supposed to, which, of course, makes sense because human health and human life shouldn't be a commodity. It should be something that, you know, we enjoy and seek to promote on its own. But when it's done through a capitalist mechanism such as issuing bonds, it doesn't, quotes, work, at least work in a capitalist sense. So that's what the Financial Times published this article on, and we can kind of dig more into it. But really, I think it's kind of showing the kind of extremes that these institutions will engage in to try to profit off of human misery, and also how these capitalist mechanisms don't actually solve those problems and don't actually create the type of environments that where people don't have to suffer through these sorts of outbreaks of disease.
Before we move on, what is a bond? We should explain that first.
Yeah, absolutely. So a bond is really just, think of it like a loan. So if I am a company and I issue bonds, people can buy these bonds and they have a certain price associated with them. And the bond promises that I will pay them out a certain amount of interest over a certain period of time. Higher risk bonds usually have much higher interest rates and shorter periods of time, and lower risk bonds pay out less over a longer period of time, but they're lower risk. And then the funds that the bond issuer gets, so I've issued these bonds, I now get this money because these people bought these bonds, and now I go ahead and do something with that money. In this case, it would be to spend that money on the creation of medical infrastructure. So it's essentially issuing debt and having these countries take on more debt to finance public services that would prevent outbreaks of severe diseases.
Daniel, I'm still unclear as to how this money is supposed to help the poor and the sick and the people who are suffering from Ebola or influenza or any of these other dread diseases. I get that the bonds are issued. I get that investors buy the bonds. And in fact, the interest rates are quite high, 6.5 over LIBOR and 11.1 over LIBOR. But how does this money, or how is the money supposed to get to the poor or to the affected?
So it's supposed to be then under state control, right? So the states get the money and they've earmarked it and are only supposed to use it for these particular purposes of creating hospitals, for example, purchasing vaccines, hiring doctors or other medical professionals. So it's supposed to flow through that then the state takes on this debt, takes the money, invests it in these infrastructure, it benefits people, and then they pay out a certain percentage to the investors that gave them money. And what you're seeing in this dynamic is that classic flow of wealth from, you know, less developed nations to fully developed nations in the West, who typically have the type of free capital to invest in bonds, where now they have to pay actually pretty high interest rates. 6.5% over LIBOR or 11.1% is a pretty good chunk of money. So you have these countries that can't really afford their own infrastructure because they don't really control their own wealth. It's largely controlled by multinational corporations that export their wealth out of those countries. So the people in the state there don't get to benefit from it. So they're desperate for more money. And then investors come in and say, sure, we'll give you money, but we want these big interest rates. It's brokered by the World Bank, which we started at the beginning. And the World Bank's job is to ensure that people pay up, that it's a way of saying, don't worry, you have this powerful global institution called the World Bank behind this deal, and they're going to make sure that the Democratic Republic of the Congo or whatever other nation pays out as a way of trying to attract investors. And they also, the World Bank has powerful mechanisms of legislation and regulation to force payment from those countries to ensure that investors get what they want. So that's in a nutshell how it works. What I think we're seeing is the limitations of kind of financial instruments to actually benefit people in a substantial way. And I think it really points to this kind of colonial status that many of these lesser developed nations still struggle and suffer under at the hands of the West, where now their sick people and their tendency to have horrible outbreaks become a potential source of profit because they're desperate to sell these bonds and take out these loans because, of course, they want to try to stop, you know, disease outbreaks and can't get financing any other way.
There's kind of an interesting historical detail that I noticed in here. This is a little bit of a tangent, but I think there's sort of an important political lesson to draw from this. It really shows how you can be, you know, an imperial power even without really a military, you know, like, imperial powers can impose their will on the oppressed countries of the world using financial instruments, not just military instruments, or, you know, not even at all really military instruments. So the coupons on these loans, this is a paragraph from the article that we're talking about. The coupons are paid by donor nations, Germany and Japan. Okay, that's interesting. Well, Germany and Japan were the two principal countries that the United States and their allies fought against in World War II. They were allowed back in the club at the end of World War II, very different than World War I, where they were punished. But the deal was basically, we'll resuscitate your economy, but you can't really have an army, right? In the case of Japan, they actually had to put it into their constitution that they, you know, renounced war now and forever. And yet, by virtue of their economic strength, by virtue of being, you know, financial centers, so, you know, this is just one example of the pandemic bonds that we're talking about. But, you know, there's also, you know, Japan runs the Asian Development Bank. Germany is kind of the principal player in the European Union. You know, through the mechanisms of finance, you can actually exercise just as much control over countries as you could if you had, like, troops occupying them.
Yeah, and I think that shows the global kind of power that the financial services industry now has. Because the truth is, they didn't occupy these countries militarily originally just for the, you know, pleasure of occupying it militarily. The purpose was to extract its resources. Many nations in Africa have tremendous deposits of oil, gold wealth, precious metals. They have a lot of commodities of tremendous value. So it would stand to reason that, therefore, under capitalism, these countries would benefit tremendously and be able to generate huge wealth through the sale of these various commodities. But what we see instead, of course, is that the seizure of these countries militarily was then replaced by the seizure of these countries financially, and ensuring that they'd remain kind of in debt to the West forever, which is what we're seeing here. And you're right, Japan and Germany obviously don't militarily occupy these countries. Like you said, Japan doesn't even really have a military per se. And yet they're still able to extract resources from these countries because they are, you know, staunch supporters of the kind of Western capitalist order. That's really important. And that is how we continue to exert control of these nations. And you can imagine if the Democratic Republic of the Congo decided to buck these bonds or, you know, refuse to pay them back and, you know, seize the funds of the investors. If they behaved in these ways, organizations like the World Bank and the U.S. Treasury have all kinds of powerful mechanisms to sanction them, to exclude them from financial networks, to cut off their banks from access to payment networks, and really punish and choke these countries if they ever dare to not, you know, handle the investors' funds in a way that they felt was appropriate. And you can see them doing that to countries all over the world now, Venezuela, the DPRK, Iran, where these countries that dare to utilize their nation's wealth for the benefit of people and not for Western investors now suffer under economic sanctions and have all kinds of, you know, instability, price fluctuations, currency devaluations, et cetera, that really damage their economy. And that is an exertion and extension of that neocolonial power, which we see even now.
The vaccine bonds that we're talking about are a relatively new invention, but it falls under the umbrella of something that's been around for a while. That's catastrophe bonds, they're sometimes called. So even though, I mean, this is new, right? It's for infectious diseases. But the idea of taking advantage of a country that's dealing with a tremendous turmoil or crisis, or, you know, the example that comes to mind is Haiti in the aftermath of the devastating earthquake several years ago, the big banks and Western corporate, and actually the Clinton Foundation kind of came in and really took over the country. Talk a little bit about this broader concept of catastrophe bonds, catastrophe capitalism.
Yeah, unfortunately, the truth is that catastrophe can be profitable and that people can take advantage of it. I mean, on a previous show, I talked about how Harvard is buying up all the water in California because they anticipate that climate change will cause drought, and therefore they'll be able to crank up the price of water in the future because, of course, people will buy it. What can you do? You can't stop drinking. It's not a luxury. And this is the same idea. So when you talk about Haiti, you have this earthquake that devastated the region. You have a whole bunch of people who are really concerned about the many lives that are being lost and threatened to be lost there and the loss of infrastructure. So you have tons of money flowing in there from donors. But of course, what you've seen and what we now know in retrospect is the vast majority of that wealth did not go to the poor people who were struggling to survive amidst desperate conditions, but went to NGOs, foundations like the Clinton Foundation, and enriched the various executives that ran them. That it was really just kind of a ransacking and an opportunity to use people's very good intentions to help, people abroad in desperate circumstances as a way of enriching themselves, which is what you're seeing now. I think the World Bank example is just a more blatant example of it, where people look at, an outbreak of Ebola, and rather than saying, oh my gosh, what terrible human misery, we have the means to solve this disease even now, let's put into action. Instead, what they say is they look at it and they say, well, how can I make money off of this? I'd like to help them, but how is that going to help my bottom line? How is that going to help me make more? Unfortunately, this is a very common way the West has viewed these countries historically as an opportunity to profit. And it should come as no surprise to us that they look at these outbreaks of diseases as yet another opportunity rather than, a humanitarian crisis where we have a moral obligation to help human beings who are suffering with serious diseases and poverty.
There are some new developments, too, turning to a new subject, some new developments related to PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric. Walk us through those.
Yeah, so we've brought up PG&E a number of times. As we now know, Pacific Gas and Electric is going through bankruptcy because it's facing a whole host of lawsuits and regulatory fines for its blatant neglect, which led to the wild record out-of-control wildfires here in California, which destroyed some cities, left thousands homeless, killed a large number of people as well. And now what we're seeing is, they've declared bankruptcy, which is to say basically that they're not going to pay out a lot of things, and bankruptcy law prevents them from doing it. And what they've decided to do is they're going to cut $130 million in employee bonuses because of they're using, of course, the excuse as of this bankruptcy is a reason why they can't do it. What I think is really important, some 14,000 employees were eligible for this money. And when we talk about these employees, these are the people installing power lines. These are the people cutting down dead trees. These are the people, maintaining and building the infrastructure of PG&E. These are workers, these are average everyday people who are not allowed to make decisions at the executive level in terms of where PG&E builds, if it builds safer infrastructure, if it takes significant action to protect the community from catastrophe related to climate change. They're not included in these decisions, right? They're not allowed to express those opinions. All they do is simply go in the direction they're pointed in. The executives say, repair this area or fix this area or install this area, and they do. So what it really means is while these executives have profited handsomely and the CEO even departed PG&E while in disgrace with, I believe it was $2 million, she also profited handsomely before the catastrophes as well. The executives have no problem. It's the workers who are not directly at fault for this, who weren't able to make decisions about infrastructure, who are now going to be punished and who are now going to lose their benefits. And PG&E knows this, right? Because they understand the political climate right now. They're protected by the bankruptcy laws. They're going to make it sound like, well, what can we do? We got to take all this money from these people. We messed up. And that's what we're seeing here. So I think it's really important when we talk about PG&E is who's getting hurt from this and who's benefiting from this. And what it looks like is the executives at PG&E are doing just fine. They're not going to lose their homes. They're not going to lose their jobs or see their wages cut back. But the workers most certainly are, to say nothing, of course, of the many, working people who lost their homes in the wake of the fires. So I think this is an important step that we need to point out, is to see how, under capitalism, even in disasters, working people get hurt far, far more than the executives that control these companies.
What's going to happen to utilities in the state of California now that Pacific Gas and Electricity is in this process of bankruptcy and, you know, as you're saying, in the process, really doing a serious injustice to its employees by canceling $130 million in bonuses? What will happen to utilities? I mean, could consumers see their prices go up?
Guaranteed they will. What I imagine will happen is PG&E's stock price is terrible right now, right? It's crashed because of this bankruptcy filing, amongst other things. And what you're going to see is you're going to see some private equity fund or a hedge fund see this as a profit-making opportunity and say, wow, this price sure is cheap. But if we look at PG&E in the long term, they have monopoly control over power in California. We're going to be able to buy a large stake in the company for relatively cheap. And then from there, we can continue to up prices as a way of trying to restore profitability. I believe that that's probably what's going to happen. So the end result is going to be that your average California consumer is going to have to pay more for their utilities so that whatever investors decide to buy PG&E on the cheap can then crank up the prices as much as possible to try to restore profitability. And this is what happens, right? When gas and electricity is considered a commodity for sale versus a human right, a human need, this is what we're going to see. Because unfortunately, you know, under our current economic system, these are not considered human rights. These are considered speculative things. But of course, that's crazy, right? None of us can do without electricity. It's not a luxury. We can't just say, oh, I don't want to buy electricity this month. I can do without, or I don't need gas this month. It'll be fine. We need it to function even in a very basic way. And when we can start charging that, it's guaranteed profit. And you're going to see an increase in prices because what else are we going to do? I can't go to another company to get my electricity. I'm going to have to do my best to try to pay that PG&E bill.
Let me ask you too, Daniel, PG&E, before it filed for bankruptcy, was determined to have not caused those devastating fires in Northern California. So wasn't the bankruptcy filing just to sort of temporarily hold off creditors, allow them to reorganize, and then just go right back into normal business mode again?
I mean, I think the bankruptcy was in part to protect itself from a lot of these creditors that it has to pay out to, and also investors as well. I do think there's going to be a host of lawsuits regardless. And even if, you know, in a court, they're not found liable, I still think it's going to cost them a tremendous amount of money to fight these. And frankly, you know, the political environment here is such that the legislators and the powers that be are going to have to throw something to the California people. You know, what's happened is just so devastating and untoward. And to have PG&E walk away from it, you know, unscathed, I think would be very unlikely. So I think there will be liability found for them, at least in a civil court. I do think that there will be some payments out to the victims, although it won't nearly be enough to cover their what they've lost. I think they'll get, you know, a tiny fraction of that and ultimately lose out. And yeah, it could be that bankruptcy was kind of a sort of cynical way of manipulating the situation to try to not have to pay people out. And even if it wasn't, that doesn't change the fact that that's exactly what it does, is it says to people, sorry, you're not getting your money. In this case, you know, you 14,000 employees who were working for our company, you don't get any bonuses because what can we do? We burned down the state and now we can't pay you any money.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. He joined us every Tuesday for the weekly series False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. Daniel, let's move on to the next story. There's a trend that you flagged for us in the economy where, on the one hand, unemployment or official unemployment is going down. It's reaching historic lows. But counterintuitively and counter to how, you know, it's theoretically, abstractly supposed to work, wages and workers' income is not necessarily going up. Why is that?
Yeah, I think that's a really important trend to notice, because what kind of neoclassical economics, which is the economics that really dominates the school of economics today, it's certainly what people on Wall Street follow when they think about the economy and write articles about it, is that when there's less workers available, they're going to have to pay more for those workers. So ultimately, the workers' wages will increase or benefits will increase. So what we've seen now is a very, very low unemployment rate. It's record low since, I think, 1968. It was this low, if I'm not mistaken. And yet, so then according to neoclassical economics, we should see a big increase in purchasing power for consumers. We should see workers making more. But we're not seeing workers make more. In fact, we're seeing their wages mostly stagnate. And so this article goes on to talk about that. And of course, you know, it tries to speculate it and tries to say, you know, well, you know, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. I think there's a couple of things that we can point out to is why this is happening. One of them is that the way we calculate unemployment is really extremely deceptive. If I work part-time 20 hours a week at Starbucks, I'm considered employed, and yet everybody knows you can barely make ends meet working 20 hours a week at Starbucks. You can go even further. If I work, if I get paid $10 this month to mow someone's lawn, technically, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor and Statistics, I'm employed, right? So I made $10 that month mowing a lawn. I now get ticked off the unemployed chart, which is, of course, crazy because that's not real employment. That's no one would consider that having a job, but the U.S. Department of Labor does. So when we say that it's record low unemployment, that could be people who drove an Uber for a couple of hours. That could be people who had their hours cut back, but not completely eliminated, so they're still technically employed. And what it shows is that workers continue to be making less in this particular economy. I think another factor is the record low union membership. In spite of the really heartening and inspiring strikes that we've seen throughout the teachers' unions and educators in general, union membership is down. And workers have very little organized labor and very little leverage to command higher wages. And so in that environment, what you see is continually record high profits for these corporations, low unemployment, but workers still being squeezed and not being paid, you know, really their fair share for the hard work that they've done. It kind of, you know, defeats the rhetoric, especially of the last administration, that it was all about jobs, 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 and we're going to make more jobs. And Trump, you know, trumpeted that loudly. And then we saw the unemployment rate plummeting over the last year. And the Wall Street Journal and other articles were crowing about it and saying, look, Trump's doing what he said. Look at all these jobs he's creating. Everything's great. And then, of course, now the hangover, when we actually get to it and we say, okay, so how much money was made? What's the average situation for workers? And what we're seeing is still very flat wage, very minimal benefits, et cetera, which really throws the lie that somehow this administration was going to make things better economically, or that a low unemployment rate actually influences what goes into people's pockets.
Yeah, it always seemed to me that the most like obvious glaring error that mainstream economics makes is the presumption that there's this like wall between the economy on the one hand and politics on the other, when the two things are actually just like one integrated whole. You know, I'm referring specifically to what you were talking about with unions, right? So, okay, the question of, you know, compensation in an economy is not simply, you know, dictated by these sort of abstract, personless mechanisms of the market that just sort of happen whether or not somebody wants it to, or you know, it just happens. It's actually the result of a political relationship, the balance of power between workers and bosses. And the same thing could be said about, say, the movement to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. I mean, that would, you know, drastically remake all these statistics that we're talking about. But that's, again, a fundamentally political struggle. Those two things are you can't understand one in isolation from the other.
I think that's really important when we talk about the political in it, because these economists like to position themselves as if they're apolitical, right? Like they just stand outside of it and provide data. And yet when you look at how the U.S. Bureau of Labor and Statistics calculates employment, you can see that is patently absurd, right? No economist would actually consider that real employment, or such a wide range, all the way from someone who's employed at a hedge fund making six figures down to someone who mowed a lawn for $10, that they're all employed and they're all in the same thing. No serious social scientist would look at that and say, sure, that's basically apples and apples, no differences there. So then why did they record employment this way? Why do they look at it this way? Well, of course, to paint as positive a picture of the U.S. economy as possible. They also get to leave out unemployed people who are incarcerated, right? If you're in prison, you're not considered employed or unemployed, you're incarcerated. So we have record high incarceration rates, higher than anywhere else in the world, both absolutely and as a percentage. So all of a sudden, those people aren't considered unemployed, they're just in jail. And so there's a way you can massage the numbers. And why are you massaging the numbers? Because there's a political goal here. And the political goal is to make workers feel like they're the best country on earth, that even though things are hard for them, this is as good as it gets, so don't worry about it, that don't worry, the unemployment's low, so you should just appreciate what you have. There's a political end to it. It's not just about providing data. It's not just about giving people information. It's about making a point. I always think of Spain, for example, which has record high unemployment. For young people, it's like 25% or something like that. And part of that, the reason why their unemployment is so high and ours is so low, is because Spain doesn't incarcerate its citizens the way we do. If it had such mass incarceration such that we do here in the United States, there'd be tremendous civil unrest in Spain. The citizens would not stand for it. They'd fill the streets. There'd be, you know, it'd be an uprising, to say the least. Yet in the United States, we've been able to sell this message of mass incarceration that if you're charged by the cops or you're in jail, you've automatically done something bad, case closed. And so that's another way we're able to artificially lower the unemployment rate and prevent social unrest such that you would see in Spain. So there are political ends to this, is the point. The economy just doesn't exist in this, you know, space of pure science and empiricism. It is trying to make a political point. It is trying to push a political agenda.
Yeah, such an important point about mass incarceration, especially when you think of, you know, where does that apparatus, that institution of mass incarceration in the United States come from? A lot of people argue, and I agree with this, that it's basically a consequence of the deindustrialization of the U.S. economy, where people who could otherwise count on, you know, jobs that, you know, like stable working class jobs, stable because, you know, they were largely unionized, those industries were largely shipped over to other countries, right, where workers could be exploited even more deeply. And so as workers become unnecessary, right, as the people who run this country would call it, the surplus population increases. Well, what do? Well, you just put them in cages. You just put them in prison. I mean, it's a monstrous system.
I think it's no surprise that turn towards outsourcing, towards globalization, where we started utilizing the cheap labor in foreign markets, such as China and a lot of different Southeast Asian countries. That was Reagan really altering the regulations and the tax regime such that it became immensely profitable and possible for corporations to do that. Simultaneously, Reagan also launched the war on drugs. And this is because his advisors and bureaucrats were not stupid. They knew that this outflow of capital away from the United States would result in massive loss of jobs. And what do you do when you have a whole bunch of unemployed people? Well, if you just leave them alone, they're going to start organizing and they're going to start demanding more. So you create this phony war on drugs, right? These people that are forced into poverty. So what do to survive? How do you pay rent? Well, you do something illegal, because given the choice between doing something illegal like selling marijuana on the side and starving to death or going homeless, it's pretty easy calculation to make. So it's no surprise that we launched the war on drugs at the same time, because we needed to launch mass incarceration. We needed to demonize this population, make them appear to be a bunch of lazy drug dealers, welfare queens, etc., so that we could imprison them, because they would very shortly be out of jobs. And that administration knew that was happening. And of course, that continues to this day. And we can see the end results of that.
A day in the life of America. That was the voice of Daniel Sankey, who joined us from San Francisco. He's a financial policy analyst. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.